I just went through my appointment schedule. I have, you know, a certain number open, but not an infinite quantity of times open for appointments. And so I'm going to give first priority to those who are writing the major paper and want to talk about it. Now, you don't have to see me about a major paper if you're quite sure that, of what you want to do and if it ties in with what we're doing in the course. It's not necessary to check it out with me first, but if you do want to talk about it, I want to give those people the opportunity to do that. So that's my first priority on that. So I guess what I want to say is, if that's the condition that you're in, then please see me as quickly as possible to line up an appointment for that, so that I have that taken care of, and that you're not waiting until December 24th to do that. Okay. What we took in the last class, the new material in the last class, it dealt, first of all, with a further elaboration. I did this during the review, but it was actually new material. A further elaboration of psychic experience in the in-between of limitation and transcendence. We talked more about that, the experience of the psyche in the in-between of limitation and transcendence. The participation of the psyche in the rhythms and processes of the body, and the participation of the psyche in the movement of intentionality toward the intelligible, the true and the real and the good and the divine. That twofold participation of sensitive psychic experience sets up a basic law for psychic development. A law that, following Lonergan, I call the law of limitation and transcendence. If you want to see his discussion of that, of the law of limitation and transcendence, which he says is a law for the development of everything that develops in the concrete universe, but it's realized analogously in different kinds of beings. It's in Insight, around page 472 to 479. Law of limitation and transcendence. I'm taking that discussion that he proposes there and applying it specifically to the experience of the sensitive psyche. He really doesn't do that. I'm making use of the general principle of the law of limitation and transcendence, a law that characterizes all development. I'm taking it and applying it to the development of the sensitive psyche. So, psychic health then would consist in the poised equilibrium of the psyche between the two contraries of limitation and transcendence. We're going to discuss today a little bit another way of coming at the notions of limitation and transcendence, besides the one that we've used so far. But psychic health would be that poised equilibrium between those two contraries. That poised equilibrium allows both for the continual integration of past experience and for the cumulative operation of further differentiation as one meets new experiences, the further differentiation through which development takes place. Kierkegaard, I think, is getting at the same thing. We're going to discuss Kierkegaard in detail in the next class. When he speaks of movement on the spot, movement on the spot, movement that is placed, movement that is poised, poised movement of the healthily developing psyche, the healthily developing person. We've seen that displacement heads in the limit either to depression or to schizophrenia, and I gave you the interpretation of Ernest Becker, according to which most culturally normal people would be about there on the continuum, in the direction of depression. That is to say, not realizing the extent of the possibilities that they do have, and not actuating the possibilities that they do have, but buying into a cultural framework in which their possibilities are too determined for them by the ways of the culture. Too determined, that are not independent enough from the determinations of the cultural mores to set their own course in life. All right, the root of the tension, and here's where I'm going to try to get into just one other way of coming at the same thing, because I think it can be talked about in many ways. This then is really kind of new material, even though it's dealing with something that we've talked about in the last class. But the root of the tension lies in the fact that we, in our being, experience, I believe, two different sets of what Lonergan calls schemes of recurrence. Schemes of recurrence. We experience two different sets of schemes of recurrence, and they are in tension with each other. The schemes of recurrence of the body seem to be almost cyclical. Almost. And so much so that there are a number of cultures who seem to exist in an almost cyclical time. But the schemes of recurrence of the body are more fixed. They are not really cyclical. Nothing is cyclical. Nothing is really cyclical. What you have are more or less fixed schemes of recurrence. But in the body, for instance, you know, it just proceeds. If A happens, B happens. If B happens, C happens. If C happens, D happens. If D happens, A happens. And it goes over and over and over again. You can take a number of the different systems of our anatomy and discuss them precisely in that way. And it's only when, for instance, D doesn't happen that the whole thing doesn't start all over again. But we have a relatively fixed set of schemes of recurrence in the body. And in the, just this, let me fill this out with the other question on it. Whereas intentionality sets up, is the source of new schemes of recurrence. Through insight, judgment, and decision. Through our intentionality, we are relatively free from the fixed schemes of recurrence that you would find in, for instance, the other animal species. We can introduce novelty into the universe through insight, judgment, and decision. We can and do change being. We make being in a way that is simply not true, to an extent that is simply not true of other orders of the universe, of other, including other animal species. And particularly our capacity for free decision is a capacity to introduce novelty into the universe of being. And we introduce novelty by making history. A very definite sense in which the other animal species do not have a history. Not in the same sense in which you can say that with humanity. Okay. So, you can think of this tension of limitation and transcendence, huh? As a tension between two orders of time. And you can think of the poised equilibrium as balancing these two orders of time, as enabling us to live in the balance between two orders of time, and to negotiate the two different orders of time in a steady, processive, cumulative fashion. In this sense, then, the depressed person is too locked into cycles, into routine. It's as true of the depressed person's psyche as it is of the depressed person's body. That if A happens, B happens, if B happens, C happens, if C happens, B happens, if D happens, A happens, and it starts all over again. It's as true of their psyche as it is of their body, almost. That's another way of describing what you mean by depression, that they're locked into fixed schemes almost as much as their cardiovascular system is. The routine, the rut, and the hopelessness of ever getting out of it, the no-exit feeling. So the depressed psyche is living in a kind of time that approaches cyclical time. Whereas the schizophrenic psyche is out of time. It is introducing novelty to such an extent, you see, that it is no longer in the real world. It is living in a fantasy world. The novelty is so novel that being has been remade, been recreated in the schizophrenic psyche. The schizophrenic person is no longer who he or she is. The schizophrenic person is now Napoleon, or the Messiah, or God, or what have you. The novelty is not sufficiently rooted in the real. So they are living in an order of time in which the novelty that they introduce is discontinuous with the rhythms and processes of the body and the material nature. So you can think of this then in terms of those two kinds of time, or two orders of time as well. And in coming at it that way, you could say this, that we have to start from ourselves and the world as they are, and move to ourselves and the world as we might want them to be. The depressed person can't do the second of those two. The depressed person is locked into the self and the world as they are, and cannot move from those to the self and the world as he or she wants them to be. The schizophrenic person is definitely making the self and the world what, in a sense, they want them to be, but they're not starting from the world as it is. And so the balance is to start from the world as it is and to move toward the world or the self as you want them to be. Another way of stating the same thing. So the tension then in this way of coming about it is a tension between two arrangements of time, between the seemingly cyclical time of routine and the seemingly discontinuous time of pure novelty. We are not meant to live exclusively in either, but rather to achieve the poised equilibrium of the two. Now, I could go on in this. I think that there's a lot that you could do with this whole thing in terms of the role of the conversions that we talked about in establishing the balance. Because I think that it's true to say that intellectual conversion, the owning of your own capacity for insight and judgment, takes you out of cyclical time. Intellectual conversion, it would be a liberation from cyclical time. Paulo Freire, in Pedagogy of the Oppressed, is introducing a kind of intellectual conversion to the people he's dealing with. And precisely what he's doing is freeing them from the overdetermination of cyclical time and enabling them to recognize the fact that by their own insights, they can understand the world and their situation, and by their own freedom, they can change it. It's a kind of intellectual conversion. It's an owning of that creative vector, coming to recognize it and own it. So there's a sense in which intellectual conversion is a liberation from cyclical time, and psychic conversion is a liberation from the discontinuity of novelty. Because psychic conversion will continue to call the intelligent, rational existential subject back to his or her roots in the body. Precisely what psychic conversion is, it sets up that link between intentionality and the rhythms and schemes of the body. So those two conversions, I think, are operative in helping us to establish the equilibrium of the two directions in which we can go. And one other point here that I want to make on this is that I think these arrows, these little arrows that I introduced last time, are very important in this whole thing. We're not always, you know, right on the spot at every moment. A new decision which can be made in peace will carry you over in this direction, in the direction of transcendence, of going beyond. Or a new differentiation of consciousness will bring you into this direction. And then what needs to be done is to give yourself the time to integrate the novelty. St. Ignatius, in his Rules for Discernment, is sensitive to this, that a decision can be made in peace, but then it's very important to watch what happens after the decision is made, to make sure that you don't lose the integrity of the decision that was made. And I think what he's on to there is the need for the integration of the cyclical rhythms of the body into the new position that you've taken through the decision. You need to be sensitive to that. You need to give it time. And the same thing, I think, is true of new differentiations of consciousness. Piaget has studied how, in the adolescent, theory develops, the capacity for theory. Try to think back to your first theoretical experience, and I'm sure you've all had, you know, a first theoretical experience, where, you know, you came to realize the capacity that you have for elaborate mental constructions, and the excitement that is released at that point. And Piaget is very, very good at describing the emotional excitement that comes with the release of the theoretical capacity in the adolescent, where the adolescent intellect has gone wild in the construction of an intelligible framework. All right, now, first of all, the framework that is constructed may or may not be right. And in addition to being intelligent, we need to be reasonable, that is to say, to check out whether or not the theory is right. The other part of this is that when a new differentiation takes place, and this is what Piaget is very sensitive to, there's a tremendous emotional outburst at the same time. Tremendous emotional breakthrough and excitement, you see. Now, that needs to be given time. The person needs to be given time to integrate that emotional excitement and to, in a sense, dissipate the excitement of the emotion. Or otherwise, the person is liable to be carried pretty far in this direction. If the emotion takes the theoretical capacity and starts running with it, and doesn't allow the person to say, hey, now, wait a minute, check this out against the evidence, then you've got the danger again with a new differentiation, which is itself a matter of development, running away from the person, the new differentiation not being integrated with the rest of the individual. Does that make sense? All right, that's really all I want to say on that basic limitation transcendence model. And I'll indicate also what I took on the anagogy context and the symbol. But Keith, you had a question.
Yeah, I was wondering when you were talking about that curve, the practical
thing. On the what?
We talked about the current.
Oh, yeah.
Cyclic, almost cyclic. I just wondered
if you made a practical sense of somebody's experience. In the body itself. I don't know. If we had a neurophysiologist here, you could do this much more precisely than I can do. But in the circulation of the blood, for instance, and the cardiovascular system, you see, if a certain thing happens, then you know, the next thing will happen. And if that happens, the next thing will happen, and so on and so forth. And then it starts all over again. The scheme of recurrence is the... As long as B, C, and D happen, A will happen again, and we'll start the whole thing. It's a scheme of recurrent action.
Well, I guess I'm thinking about, are you talking physiology, or are you talking like if somebody, lost or something, and that was...
Well, it happens, the schemes of recurrence happen in all the different orders of reality, you see. But in the body schemes of recurrence are much more fixed than the schemes of recurrence, for instance, that happen in human relationships, you see. Because in human relationships, you see, all right, if A happens, B happens. If you insult me, I get angry. If I get angry, I hurt you. If I hurt you, A starts all over again. Okay? But it doesn't have to be. See, in the same way that the pumping of the blood happens without your entering into it at all. At one point, you see, you can intervene here with insight, judgment, decision. It's not as fair. It's not as fair.
Stephen is working with
transactional analysis categories. So those categories wouldn't make sense if, in fact, we didn't have some kind of ability to change the schemes that can happen. So we have an ability to recognize the scheme and make an adjustment in a way that, so that the scheme is not quite as fixed. Or, you know, the whole Oedipal thing. Freud wants to put that forward as though it is a scheme of recurrence that's as fixed as the blood, you see, and will carry with you throughout your life. Possibly he wants to anyway. And yet, what's the whole point of his trying to raise that to consciousness? Except to free you from it, you see, by giving you insight into it, so that you don't have to go through life killing your father. You see. Instead of killing him, you start to understand him. And then the scheme is broken. So insight, judgment, and decision give a certain flexibility to those schemes.
Okay, well, then when you look at it just purely from a physiological thing,
okay, the point that I'm trying to make is that the psyche of the depressed person is almost as cyclic as the body, you see. The psychic experience is almost as cyclic as the body. Now, I think you could move that over into other... You know, I was talking to Stephen this morning about bioenergetics and the studies that they've done of depressed, the bodies of depressed persons and so on. Now, I just don't have that data under my control, you know, to talk about even that, you know, what happens to the bodies of those people. But what I'm trying to get at the fact that the psyche becomes almost as fixed in its schemes of returns as the body itself. It doesn't see anything out.
Yes. When we get close to that line between physiological versus relational, in that area, is there a particular view or perception that we have that affects this transition, if you call it that? For example, in our day-to-day living, we cannot really change the extent, the fact that we need sleep, we have to eat, and that cycle, mm-hmm. and also the birth, living, death cycle, mm-hmm. greater level. Mm-hmm. That it affects not only our physiological functions, but also our the relation, our psychical functions on the relational level.
I think I understand that.
Particularly, well, I think you probably do think of a depressed person and reduced to its very basic. the day-to-day functions, for example, the relational aspect.
Yeah, it's true. Now, in that thing, you know, all right, what do we have the power to change? too. I think your question raises that. You know, again, there are limits to the power that we have to change, and if you transgress those limits, and you do so, the dream that my friend had about with the heart attack, I think it's pointing to the danger of the transgression of the limits that are placed upon him because of his commitment to the full theory. All right, very quickly on the other stuff that we took in the last class. I argued in the seventh section of the outline on the anagogic context that life is a movement that has a direction that can be found or missed. First of all. And secondly, that direction is found by the operations of the creative vector. But thirdly, if you agree with my position on this, those operations come to term only in the knowledge and love of God. When they reach their fullness. Now, if all of that is the case, then the final context for our experience of the movement of life is that anagogic context. In fact, caught by the major Christian thinkers and others outside the Christian tradition, in the West, by Plato, certainly.
Did you read that last statement again?
Yeah, that, those operations through which we find the direction will come to term only in the knowledge and love of God. Right? And if that is the case, then the final context for understanding our experience of the movement of life is that anagogic context. That's what Augustine is getting at. Our hearts are restless until we rest in it. And our hearts are precisely what he's getting at there, using the word heart, precisely our experience of the movement. And then I discussed in the last class some of the direct experiences of the anagogic context, both in dreams and in waking experience. I referred you to books like William James and Rudolf Otto. And then, from that context, introduced the notion of symbol. The characteristics of the symbol, there were five of them that we talked about in the last class. First of all, the relationship between symbol and feeling. Secondly, that symbol opens upon something other than itself. Thirdly, the internal communication set up by symbolic experience. Fourthly, the rootedness of the symbol in the past, but its anticipation of the future at the same time. Fifth, the sacramental character of the symbol. Now, on that business of the sacramental, I want to say this, that the symbol gives what it symbolizes. I would say that psychic symbols approach that character as they approach being anagogic, if you want. And they actually have that character when the symbol itself is an experience of grace. When the psychic symbol is an experience of grace, then what is symbolized is healing in the grace experience. And I think that's something of a qualification. What I said there in the last class. All right, are there any questions on any of that? Okay, now what I want to do, I want to telescope a bit here on the outline. And I'm going to take the rest of 7 and all of 8 and all of 9 in one grand sweep. Okay? And it can be done and it will be done and we'll watch it and see it happen. And then, so that the new material today is basically a discussion of Jung. And but with those other things as an introduction to it. The next class will take Kierkegaard, and then the final class I'll say some things about discernment. psychology concern. All right, so where I've got there 7G, discovery of the anagogic, what I really meant there is how I discovered the necessity of using the category the anagogic. Okay? How I came to that. And that, to introduce that, will introduce us right into, bring us right into the discussion of Jung and his relationship to what we've been talking about. I came to the category of the anagogic in and through my own study of Jung and my struggles with Jung, with his psychology. And the struggles with him were twofold. First of all, to understand him. And secondly, to, once having understood him, to redirect some of the elements in his thought. And the core of the problem that I discovered had to do with good and evil, and the way in which good and evil are treated in Jung's thought. Core of the problem that I had with this work.